With all the headlines talking about the need for women's voices, it's time to hear some.
We have very narrow window of opportunity to save lives now.
Women trying to change lives overseas and here in the U.S., plus combating the invisibility problem. I'm Susan Barnett, and it's coming up today on 51%, The Women's Perspective. United Nations relief agencies are warning that the lives of millions of people in the Sahel region of West Africa are at risk. The Sahel is a belt of land across the entire continent of Africa that creates the transition between the Sahara Desert in the north and the Sudanian savannas in the south. Across that belt, there have been years of conflict and months of drought. The UN estimates that 15 million people don't have enough food, and close to 1.5 million children are on the brink of starvation. The agencies say efforts to respond to this growing humanitarian crisis are being hampered by a lack of funding. According to the agencies, only half of the nearly $800 million required to help avert a disaster in the Sahel has been received. Elizabeth Beers, spokesperson for the World Food Program, tells Patrick Maguea that time is running out.
We have very narrow window of opportunity to save lives now, because from June to September is the lean season. We have 4 weeks to procure 180,000 tons of cereal and 36,000 tons of pulses for those who need this food assistance. So far, World Food Program has got only half of the funding needs. We still need $400 million as soon as possible.
You're saying you have only 4 weeks to procure this food. If in those 4 weeks no funding comes in, what happens to the 8 million who are facing serious food shortages in the Sahel?
We will have to reduce our programs, and many lives risk of being lost because of this hunger and because of the malnutrition due to the drought. The situation has evolved since we launched this alert about Sahel in October 2011. We need to scale up our operation. But to scale up operation, we need contribution.
This is a region that is facing multiple crises. There is the drought. There is conflict. How are the agencies managing to assist people in between these catastrophes that are facing the region?
The deterioration of the situation in northern Mali has not only swollen the number of food insecure people, but also the other neighboring countries because of the restriction of movement due to insecurity. This insecurity is hindering our operation, our ability to assist those in need. But we hope we will be able to resume the operation as soon as security permits.
But is the situation getting worse and worse to reach a scale of the crisis in the Horn of Africa?
We have been so far providing food assistance for 2.2 million drought-affected people. This is already the result because those people now have got food assistance in the mostly landlocked region. This is already a success. We need to continue and scale up our operation. But for that, I repeat, we need money.
Elizabeth Beers is spokesperson for the World Food Program. That report comes to us courtesy of UN Radio. Hunger and poverty don't stop at the shores of other countries. According to the U.S. Census, poverty rates have been steadily climbing in the U.S., reaching 15% of the population in 2010. Those numbers are expected to have increased significantly as the recession continues. A study by Feeding America indicates that more than 14% of households in America are food insecure. Another 5% had very low food security. In January, the World Economic Forum published a report citing severe income disparity and chronic fiscal imbalances as the top two risks facing business leaders and policymakers this year and over the next decade. Yet America, in particular, has accepted the widest income disparity of any developed nation in the world, a growing cavern between the haves and the have-nots. Sister Helen Prejean, of Dead Man Walking fame, discusses her spiritual awakening and the problem she has with how wealthier people look down on the working class. This interview was produced by This Land Press. For more information, visit thislandpress.com.
I woke up late. I was 40 before I got it. But then I acted on it. My name is Sister Helen Prejean. I'm the author of Dead Man Walking and the Death of Innocence. I was a nun, bona fide nun, teaching parochial school kids. The parish was out by the lakefront in New Orleans with big tall trees, summer vacations, watermelon out on the green grass after the lawn had been mowed, cool lemonade. In that parish, I was out in suburbia with other white people just like me. I was unawake. The waking up to the gospel of Jesus was that call to be on the side of the poor ones. Jesus referred to them as the least of these. We had an inner city in New Orleans, a majority of whom were poor and black. That could have been in India. And I moved into the St. Thomas Housing Projects and began to live among poor and struggling African-American people. But I get in there and I just see all the rules are different. One of the things that made me realize that I had such a sense of privacy. You know, you have your own room, you have your own closet with your clothes. These families were all smashed in together. Nobody ever had anything of their own. And somebody had a fire. This family unhesitatingly brought him in, just said, come be with us. So there's a generosity in people. And it was side by side with great evil. I watched Kenny Singleton. All the sisters, we're looking out the window from our apartment. And he was having an argument with somebody over sunglasses. And the one he was having an argument with left, went up to his apartment, came down with a gun, and shot Kenny. And it was one more death. We have this thing, I think, in this country about poor people. Why don't they go get a job? Why don't they stay in school? Don't they know education is... And people have no idea. One afternoon, this kid comes in. Adult Learning Center, I said, look, we're going to work with you on an individual basis. How far did you get in school before you dropped out? I was a junior. I said, okay, look, let's give you a reading level and math, and we're going to start working with you. He couldn't read a third grade book. He couldn't read a third grade reader. In all those years in a public school, what was going on? It's complex, of course. But the truth is, I went to St. Joseph Academy. I knew how to do public speaking by the time I was a junior in high school. And that gives you agency in your life. And then you can influence others. But when you can't spell, you can't read, you don't know math, what's going to happen to that kid? We don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out.
Sister Helen Prejean was interviewed by This Land Press. Visit thislandpress.com to find out more. Coming up, the problem of invisible women and meeting the woman your mother used to be. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1190. We'll be right back. are living in a political climate where women are clamoring to be heard, whether they're incensed at policies they say limit their freedoms or frustrated with policies they say are undermining society. Either way, there is no worse feeling than feeling invisible. Writer Kathy Kekulius says that's a feeling common to almost every American woman once she's past the first blush of youth. But she found that some cultures not only see older women, they appreciate them.
The one-piece bathing suit I bought at Macy's summer clearance sale lies across my bed. I stare at it for a long minute before picking it up. Finally, I take a deep breath, step into it, coax it up over my hips, poke my arms through the straps, and adjust the bodice. Slowly, I raise my head and look into the full-length mirror. Like a sweet Italian sausage, my ample flesh is pushed in place by a casing of black spandex. Stomach, hips, and buttocks pressed in, breasts up. Forget about a three-way mirror. There's no way I want to see what's back there. As the product of a culture that worships the young, the thin, the beautiful, coming to terms with this shifting middle-age body is difficult for me. By the time I hit my mid-40s, skin starting to sag, extra pounds padding my hips, I was banished to the realm of other women of my vintage and became invisible overnight. I had heard of this phenomenon, but now I was experiencing it firsthand. One day I existed, an attractive woman being acknowledged, admired, and the next day I disappeared. Walking down the street, I had to move aside or be bumped off the sidewalk by oncoming pedestrians. I felt like a ghost, unseen, unnoticed. I even dyed my silver hair a rich shade of reddish brown, but still they couldn't or wouldn't see me. Unlike Rip Van Winkle, who fell asleep and awakened after a century to a new world, for me, a mere decade or two passed in a heartbeat. And the changes I saw were not so much in my surroundings, but in myself. Each birthday reinforced what I was becoming, an older woman. But I didn't feel like one. In my mind's eye, I am eternally 30-something, and the image in the mirror with the double chin, drooping cheeks, and deep furrow across her forehead is a shock. "Who the hell are you, and what have you done with Kathy?" I demand of the stranger staring back at me. I began to look at old people with a new understanding, empathy for those who may experience a similar mind-body disconnect, imprisoned in aging bodies but with minds mired in another time. The mature man lusts after women young enough to be his daughters or granddaughters, but are perfect for the age that he perceives himself to be. The internal image of self resists the ravages of time, and I am reluctant to admit that sometimes I am attracted to men young enough to be my sons. Men my age seem stodgy, static, spiritless. Not that it matters. Neither young nor old see me. I think of the elderly women with their bright red lipstick and too strong perfume. How I used to judge them, ridiculous old biddies. But now I know they are simply trying to combat the terror of being invisible. Afraid of becoming like them, my girlfriends and I made a pact to tell each other if one of us gets too garish with our makeup or too exuberant with our Chanel No. 5, with the same gentle honesty that we use to tell each other when a slip is showing or a piece of broccoli is stuck in a front tooth. One can quickly pass from invisible to laughingstock. All around the country, a group of women are fighting back and have formed the Red Hat Society. These older women thumb their noses at Father Time and go out to dinner, to the symphony, or the theater wearing flamboyant red hats. I'd like to join them, but red isn't my color. Instead, while cocktailing in New York City, my friend Karen and I started our own club, the Black Boots Society. Our mission? to discover the best martini in Manhattan. We deliberately drape ourselves in a cloak of invisibility, knowing the freedom it can bring, and proudly refer to ourselves as the badass old bitches in black. After moving to Mexico, I never felt invisible again. In fact, I was stared at so much that I began to wonder if there was something wrong with me. Did I have a black smudge on my cheek? Zihuatanejo was a small town, and as foreigners, my husband and I stood out. At that time, few women drove cars, and I turned heads when I drive our little CJ5 Jeep, hair and skirts flying in the breeze. I soon discovered that Mexican men unabashedly appreciate women, regardless of age, dress size, or marital status. Even though I knew that those who openly admired me might fantasize about chaining me to a stove as well as a bed, I basked in the attention. I felt as if I had stepped back into the sunlight after being lost in the shadows. One afternoon, I walked to Carlos and Charlie's, a beachfront restaurant, to meet a friend for lunch. An older Mexican man, probably about my age, walking across the parking lot to his car, smiled at me and said something about a muñeca, which means doll. It took me a moment to realize that I had been paid a compliment, and I held my head higher. After being away for several months, my husband and I returned to a favorite dinner spot. The waiter, whom we've known for years, greeted me with a big hug. Not the standoffish, back-slapping abrazo that he gave Brian, but a close belly-to-belly embrace. He inhaled deeply into my hair, stood back to look me up and down, and before letting go of my hand, murmured something in Spanish that included the word mango. Sitting at our table, I pretended to read the menu and thought about what had just happened. I could only assume that he didn't mean that I looked plump and red like the fruit, but that I was as ripe and juicy as a luscious mango. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Kathy Kokolius is an artist and the author of two memoirs, Spandex and Black Boots, Essays from an Abundant Life, and What Time Do the Crocodiles Come Out?, a travel memoir of Mexico. She lives with her husband in Colony, New York, and Ixtapa, Mexico. And finally, an essay that seems perfect for Mother's Day, A Chance to Meet the Woman Your Mother Once Was. Rosemary Crystal Reynaud got that opportunity unexpectedly and was wise enough to recognize it for the gift it was.
I received a call from the staff of the assisted living for dementia community where my mother lives. They informed me that she was ill. Nothing serious, just a virus going through the residence. The next day, I bought Mom some flowers and went to visit. When I walked in her room, she was sleeping. I had opened the door slowly so I would not wake her, but she opened her eyes and smiled at me. I returned the smile. "Hey, Mom, I came down to check on you, to see how you were doing." She blinked her eyes and stretched out lazily. She raised her arms above her head and extended her legs. She stirred in a seductive way. It all seemed unusual. Because of her arthritis, Mom normally moves very slowly and painfully. But as I watched, she rearranged in the bed with the liquid fluidity of a young woman. Mom produced a peculiar smile, and with self-importance, she slowly asked, "Did you see my new baby boy?" I was confused. Was she referring to the new stuffed animal she had won at bingo a few days ago? I replied, "What baby?" "I had a new baby boy last night," she said with boastful pride. I asked, reluctant to hear the answer, "What is his name?" "Tim," she replied. I staggered. "Tim is my brother, but he is in his 40s. Shocked, I realized I was looking at my 84-year-old mother, but in her mind she was a younger woman of 42. A woman who had just delivered the long-awaited boy to the family. He would be the final child in a family of 6 girls. I watched her reposition again with contentment and self-pride. She had a smirk on her face of a job well done. I could almost hear her thinking, "Now I have accomplished my goal. I am truly fulfilled." Most children think of their parents as old, and I have often wondered what my mother was like when she was younger. My older sisters talk about a mom who did cartwheels on the front lawn. I never knew this person. I was the 4th child. Mom was knee-deep in family care when I came along. Our fun times together consisted of me standing on a kitchen chair helping her cook. By the time I was in the 3rd grade, Mom was working full-time and raising 7 children, while my father traveled frequently for business. Yet, here at this moment, instead of an 84-year-old, was a woman full of life, full of the awareness that she had accomplished a great deed, giving her husband the boy they had wanted. As she moved in the bed, stretching and talking to me about her baby, jealousy crept into my conscience. I resented the fact she had chosen the delivery of Tim to remember. Tim, the much-longed-for baby boy, the pinnacle of Mom and Dad's family goals. Oh, if he had only lived up to their vision for him. Why not relive the birth of one of us girls? My jealousy boiled within me as I thought of all the amazing accomplishments his sisters had attained. None were ever truly acknowledged. Success was just expected of us. I regained my composure. I tried to watch and perhaps glimpse a part of my mother I never knew. I felt that by gaining this insight, I could understand her as a whole woman, not just my mother. This day she was reliving was a highlight in her life. I could see it in the way she moved, her expressions. I do not ever recall seeing that look of contentment on my mother's face. She was serene. Then it slapped me in the heart. Mom was happy. I had been given the gift of seeing my mom joyful, something I had longed for, but truly thought would never happen. It was eerie to be in this situation. It was difficult to know my mother as an 84-year-old and try to relate to the 40-year-old woman that was lying in front of me. "Was he sleeping when you saw him?" she trailed. "Yes, he was," I stumbled. Even though I continued to call her mom, I could tell she did not see me as her grown daughter. I am not sure who she thought I was. Probably just a visitor. I did bring her flowers. She rolled over then, very easily, no groaning, no disjointed movements. A simple roll to her side that could easily be accomplished by a younger woman. Astonished, I backed from the room and stood in the hallway a few moments to take in the event. I had to let my brain understand the emotions my soul had felt. I had received a short glimpse of the woman about whom I had been told stories. The woman who defied her father and married the man she was in love with, a Catholic. The young girl my father said lit up a room when she entered. The one he fell in love with the first time they danced. Here was the college girl who, along with her girlfriend, traveled across the United States during World War II, stopping to take on a waitress job when they needed money. I caught a hint of the woman who lived up to the nickname Corky. Mom went back to sleep and once again became an 84-year-old. As I walked away to return home, I thought, I would have enjoyed the company of this woman.
Rosemary Crystal Raynaud is currently working on a book. She lives in New York's Capital District. You can read more at her website, rosemarycrystalraynaud.wordpress.com. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also find a regular column related to 51% at feminist.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.